Madeleine Albright, the first woman to serve as U.S. Secretary of State, was raised in the Roman Catholic Church and never suspected that her ancestors had been Jewish until 1997, when a Washington Post reporter revealed that three of her grandparents and many of her other relatives had died in the Holocaust. In her latest book, Prague Winter, Ms. Albright, who was born in Czechoslovakia, presents the information she's been able to uncover about those lost relatives and about her own childhood in Prague and in London against the backdrop of the Second World War. This book, her fifth, is published by Harper, and I'm very pleased it has brought Madeleine Albright back to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Really great to be with you. Thank you very, very much.
And before I forget, I want to wish you a happy birthday. Do you see it as one of the drawbacks of being a public figure that everyone knows
everybody
your age?
Knows. Well, I can't hide my age, and the fact that the book states exactly when I was born, so there you are. It is out there, and as I keep saying, it's better to have the birthdays than not.
Do you have anything special planned to mark the occasion?
Well, I had a wonderful party given for me last night, all my women friends, which was fabulous. And today I decided that the best thing to do was to work and talk to you.
Well, this is an interesting book because it is a family story, but it also contains a fascinating history of the time period before, during, and immediately after World War II, told from a Czech point of view. Do you imagine that American readers will be surprised by how different the war looks from a Czech perspective?
Well, I hope so. And the book is basically, I kind of talk about it as being in three layers. The inner core really is the personal family story and some about the religious background, but also my story of my father, who was a Czechoslovak diplomat, and my mother. And so at the core, as I say, it's a personal story. Then the next layer is this period of history, which is, I think, always been fascinating to a lot of people, the 37 to 48 period, where decisions were made by the major powers over the head of Czechoslovakia. And Czechoslovakia was actually a country started on the basis of Woodrow Wilson and World War I. So there are lots of aspects to it. And then the third layer, which may be the most complicated, is about the difficulty of personal and professional decision-making and the morality of decisions and the fact that things aren't always black and white and how hard the decisions are to make.
Now, the subtitle of your book is A Personal Story of Remembrance and War, 1937-1948. That covers the first 11 years of your life. What year did your parents convert?
In 1941. Just to give you a little bit of the chronology, my father was a Czechoslovak diplomat and had been serving in Yugoslavia as a press attaché when I was born. My mother decided she wanted me born in Prague, so she went back. But then he was recalled in 1938, and in March 1939, the Nazis marched into Czechoslovakia.
Well, is this when they annexed the Sudetenland?
Yes, exactly, after the Munich Agreement, which was in the fall of 1938. And so my father, who was really somebody who identified himself with the new Czechoslovakia and President Beneš, managed to get mother and me out, and we joined the government in England, the government in exile. And so in 1941 was when they converted to Catholicism. We all did at that time.
And you have all sorts of theories as to why you did. One obvious one is that in a world in which being Jewish is dangerous, it's probably better to have another religion. Is Czechoslovakia largely a Catholic country?
It is. It is. But I think this is all speculation, because one of the very sad parts of all of this is that I never had a chance to really talk to my parents about this. And so I had to speculate on these things. So I basically said that it wasn't to escape the Holocaust, because they were out. They were in England. And I think it wasn't to fool their friends, because their friends knew they were Jewish. And so my mother was a bit more spiritual than my father, and she had friends who were Catholic, and Roman Catholicism was, in fact, the majority religion. And then I do think it doesn't take a lot of speculation to figure out that they probably felt, for the safety of their one child and others that they hoped to have, that it was probably simpler at that time.
Well, though, the real question is, why did they never tell you? Why did you As you've mentioned in some earlier books you've written, why did you learn about your Jewish ancestry when you were 59 years old? And from a Washington Post reporter, how did he turn up that information about your past?
Well, again, this is speculation. I mean, the thing that I think I have to try to explain is that basically there was nothing missing in my personal story. My parents were very open in talking about their families, and that both my maternal and paternal grandfathers were in business, that they were very proud to be Czechoslovaks, that they all celebrated Christmas and Easter, and a variety of stories about games and things that they all played. So it isn't as if there were that there was no discussion of background. We had come to America in 1948 as a result of the coup in Czechoslovakia. My father asked for political asylum here, and then he went out and got a job at the University of Denver. And I think basically, and again, speculation, is that they, I think, wanted to protect us from the pain and sadness that they themselves had experienced. People ask, you know, or they said, you know, you're a relatively intelligent woman. Why didn't you ask any questions? There were never any questions to be asked. I mean, if
well, what you, about where your grand? What had happened to your grandparents?
Well, I thought first of all, I was 2 years old when I last saw my grandparents, and I have no memory of them beyond the photographs. And I was told that they had died of old age. I just assumed that that is, now that I'm 75, I have to say I take that more personally, but basically that they had died of old age, and I didn't question that. Mm-hmm. And the story really is the following, is that I had a number of different jobs, et cetera, and then I became ambassador at the United Nations when I became a public figure. And there were profiles and things written about me at the time. And I started getting letters from people, just as any public official does, some asking for money and visas. And other people would write me in Czech, which I do read, but in undecipherable handwriting, some of them. And then some of them had various facts that didn't make any sense. Like, I went to school with your father in 1915, which would have been impossible since he was born in 1909. Or had the names of the towns they came from wrong, or the names wrong, et cetera. What happened was, like, kind of November 96, I got a letter from somebody that had all the facts right and said, we knew your family to be fine Jewish families. And it was exactly at the time that I was being vetted to be Secretary of State. And I was in the White House counsel's office, and they asked me kind of the normal questions about paying taxes or having nannies. And then they said, is there anything that we should have asked you that you might want to tell us, or that we should have asked in some way? And I said, look, I've just gotten this information, and it's perfectly possible that I'm of Jewish background. And they said, so what? The president is not anti-Semitic. So over the holidays, I did talk to my own daughters and their husbands, and we talked about it, and they were obviously fascinated and perplexed and intrigued by all of it. And then what happened was, you're not allowed to talk to a journalist between the time that you've been named and the time you're confirmed. And so Michael Dobbs, who was a reporter for the Washington Post, wanted to do a profile of me. So we gave him the names of various people that he might be able to get in touch with. And what he then, on the day I was confirmed, came into my office and started handing me these hideous documents, which were the Nazis were very organized. And so they had these cards on which they had people's names and then the date and the number of the transport that they were put on to be sent to either Terezin or on to the death camps. And that was the first time. It's one thing to find out you're Jewish. It's another to find out that large numbers of your family have been sent to concentration camps. And it was horrendous, a horrendous moment. And the only way that I can really describe it is as if I'd been asked to represent my country in a marathon. And you have to remember, I was the first woman Secretary of State, and people didn't know whether a woman could be Secretary of State. So whether a woman could run in this marathon,
Well, you were the 64th Secretary of State, so that means 63 men preceded
right.
you.
All white men who were either distinguished from each other by either being clean-shaven or having mustaches and beards. When I became secretary, I had to walk down this hall, mahogany hall, with all these portraits, and I thought, well, maybe when my portrait goes up, the walls will shake a bit. I think they did, actually. But anyway, I kind of was told, you've got this very heavy package to carry, and unwrap it while you run. And so because I couldn't go there to the Czech Republic myself immediately, I asked my brother and sister to go. So that's how the story kind of became evident to me.
And they had no clue either, your brother and sister?
No, no.
Go ahead.
I think the part that's interesting, really, Leonard, is that now that my story's come out, there are a lot of people that have similar stories. I can't tell you how many people have kind of come up and say, I didn't know anything about my background, and it's not dissimilar to yours.
You lost 25 members of your family.
Right.
Your parents lost their own parents, many siblings, cousins, nieces. And it was in terrorism, which was kind of like the model concentration camp, at least for a while, where the Germans would show off prisoners and say, well, you know, obviously life isn't all that bad for them.
It's even worse than that. They had originally kind of advertised it not as a concentration camp, but as kind of a spa place where the Jews began to know, according to the research that I've done, is that they were going to be isolated and, you know, they had to wear the stars and had their rations cut and everything. But that this was a place where they could live in peace. And then when they got there, it obviously was a horrendous place. It wasn't a death camp because they sent people on to Auschwitz and other places east, but many people died, including one of my grandfathers, of typhoid because there was just rampant disease there. And so it was sadistic, in the worst possible way of having made it seem as though it wouldn't be so awful. And so many talented people were there that they had their own symphony orchestra. They had they did have schools for the children. They learned to paint, but in the meantime, they were asked to prepare each other to be sent further on. And the most sadistic thing I thought was creating a group of Jewish elders whose job it was to choose who was going to be sent on to the next camps.
Now, you mentioned that other people have had similar experiences. I interviewed, I remember some years back, somebody who had also converted, or the family had converted her to Catholicism, sent her to a convent school. And she, in this case, it was they lived in Greece. And when I asked her about feeling Jewish, she said, no, I was, you know, I grew up a Catholic, and I, no matter, now I know that I have this Jewish past, but I'm a Catholic. And did your family go to church regularly when you were a child?
Yes, and I definitely was the most religious one in the family.
You said you wanted to be a priest.
I did, which
not a nun.
Some ambition, Eddie. But no, I had an altar in my room, and I had played priest. Then when we came to America, was when I made my first communion and confirmation. I became an Episcopalian when I got married. So my story is I was raised a Catholic, became an Episcopalian, and found out I was Jewish. So it's a fairly complicated background, but I think
it's a smaller jump from Catholic to Episcopalian than from Episcopalian to Jewish. After your family moved to London, your father continued to work for the Czech government in exile with Czech President Eduard Beneš and the Czech Foreign Minister Jan Masaryk, who actually some years later was thrown out of a window, wasn't he, by the Stalinists?
Yes, and I mean, Jan Masaryk became the foreign minister when they all returned back to Czechoslovakia after the end of the war, and he was the son of the first president of Czechoslovakia, Thomas Garrigue Masaryk. And then he was somebody that was kind of without party in a very complicated coalition government and obviously a threat to the communists. And it was a big case in March 48 because he lived in an apartment in the foreign ministry and he was found in the courtyard below his apartment. And originally, the communists said that he committed suicide, And I've seen a lot of propaganda material about it saying that it was because he was disappointed in his friends in the West. So that was part of the propaganda. But the more one looks into it, it was clear that he was thrown out of the window.
My guest is Madeleine Albright, who's written a memoir called Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance and War, 1937-1948. Your family returned to Prague after the war. How aware were you at the time of what was going on and the struggle that led to the communist takeover?
Well, you know, I was 8 years old, so I wasn't. What happened was that we lived in Prague for about 3 months, right up by the Castle Square. And then my father, because of his pre-war service, was made ambassador to Yugoslavia. And I knew at that point about communists because my father said in Yugoslavia he did not want me going to school with communists. And so I had a governess. And
that was Tito already.
Tito was
in power.
Was in power, and Belgrade was a very sad and devastated place from the war. And I, you know, the little girl in the national costume that gives flowers at the airport—that's what I used to do for a living. Which is when I remember Jan Masaryk coming to Belgrade, and I met him, and he always had his right arm in a sling. And I asked my father, you know, what had happened to him, and he said he doesn't want to shake hands with communists. So, I mean, I knew enough about that. Most of what I know about how that government worked came from later research. I wrote my honors thesis at Wellesley about it and then various other things that I wrote about Czechoslovakia.
How many languages were you speaking? You had spent a fair amount of time in England, the time when we develop our language skills.
Well, I was bilingual in Czech and English. I used to have a very English accent. And then when we went to Yugoslavia, I learned to speak Serbo-Croatian. And then because I did get ahead of myself having the governess, and in Europe you can't go on to the next level until you're a certain age, so my parents sent me to Switzerland to school to learn French, which I learned fairly rapidly since they wouldn't feed me until I asked for it in French. So that's the languages that I spoke. And when we came to the United States, which was in November 1948, I will never forget kind of singing Thanksgiving songs, actually at Great Neck, Long Island. And I remember, you know, we gathered together and somebody was asking for God's blessing. And I thought, who's asking? And then I realized I was asking. And from then on, I asked. And I lost my British accent.
Yeah, I never would have guessed. I don't hear any Czech in your accent either. Now, your family was granted political asylum because of your father's history as a diplomat. Not everybody found it all that easy to become an American citizen, even if they had participated. I've heard about people who actually fought for the U.S. military and still had a hard time.
I think they're... I don't know, you know, why it was easy, but the bottom line is the following. His last assignment, he had been ambassador to Yugoslavia for 3 years, which is kind of the normal diplomatic assignment. And then in January 48, he was asked to represent Czechoslovakia in a new commission on India and Pakistan to deal with Kashmir. And then the coup happened in February 48, and he did not want to work for a communist government. And his best friends in Belgrade were the British and American ambassadors, and they advised him to take the job in order to get out and basically report to them and not to his own government, which is what he did. And then he came to the United States. He very quickly... He'd finished whatever part of his job was, and then what was given to me at some point was a letter that he wrote to Dean Acheson in which he wrote, I beg for political asylum, and he really was a political refugee. There was a, I found an article in the New York Times that said, you know, described him as a diplomat, a political refugee, and so... that is how it happened.
You also found a draft of a novel that your father had written in a box in your garage while you were looking for old letters.
Yes, and you know, I think probably the next TV show I'm going to be on is The Hoarders or something, because there's so many things that I haven't really had a chance to really go through. And I did find my father was a historian, a diplomat, a professor who'd written any number of books in terms of the history of Czechoslovakia or about Kashmir, danger in Kashmir, or what had gone on in Poland between the interwar period. And I knew he was writing a novel, but I never really took it very seriously because it didn't seem like his genre. So when I found this, it was, I think, one of the most moving things that I did find, because it details the story of a young Czechoslovak diplomat who goes back to Czechoslovakia after the war and doesn't find anybody, and tries to figure out what happened. And he met, this is in the story, he meets somebody who is deaf and mute, and he kind of takes it as a sign of the fact that one would never talk about it. At least that's my interpretation of the novel.
And that gave you a clue as to part of the history or what had happened, what he was thinking about, and one of the reasons he didn't tell you the story?
I think that it was kind of an idea that this was so horrible that nobody could ever talk about it, and he specifically couldn't. And you know, as I said earlier, this is speculation in terms of why they did what they did. My parents, it's interesting, when my children found out about all this, they said, well, we now understand why Grandma was so worried about us all the time. I mean, I used to send them out to Denver to spend the summer with my parents, and eagle eye, and they couldn't ride their bicycles around the block. And they kept saying, after they found this out, no wonder Grandma always wanted to know where we were. And we were there with when we first came to the U.S., my sister's 5 years younger, and my brother 10 years younger, and so we were a very nuclear family, and I think that they wanted to be Americans and have a new life and not burden, as I said earlier, all of us with the pain and sorrow that they had gone through.
Is Denver where your family settled when you came to this country?
Why
Denver?
Well, who knows? I mean, this is what did happen is, the Rockefeller Foundation at that time was giving grants or supporting intellectuals from Central Europe or something like that in American universities. And they found him a job at the University of Denver, where actually there was very much of an international kind of grouping in a part of the university called the Social Science Foundation. My father got a job there. Ultimately, he became dean. It was called the Graduate School of International Studies, and a couple of years ago it was renamed in his name, so it's now the Corbell School of International Studies. So, and they loved Denver. My mother used to say on a regular basis that there were two great cities in the world, Prague and Denver.
Well, you visited Terezin twice, didn't you, in an attempt to understand the whole story?
I did, and the first time I went was in the summer of 97. I was Secretary of State, and so it was not exactly a private visit, and it is a horrible place even now. I mean, it's basically composed of two parts, which is an old fortress that was built during the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and then a garrison town, which was there for the military, and that kind of looks like a town, not so bad, with a square. I went back last year when I was doing research for the book. I know that there are many, many visitors, but when I went there, I was there just being taken around with my friends, and it was spooky and quiet, and all you could do was kind of hear and visualize what a horrendous place it really was, and overcrowded and terrible conditions in every way, and forced labor, and then the part, Leonard, that is so stunning to me, and I think is one of the lessons out of this, is the International Red Cross wanted to do inspections of some of these camps, and so the Nazis set it up so that they prepared a part of Terezin to not look so bad. They show this now in terms of clean bathrooms and tiling and all kinds of things. And the international, there was a small delegation of Red Cross people that came. All of this was planned ahead of time, so they knew when it was going to happen. And they were not well prepared, the Red Cross people. And they did a whitewash. They said it was fine. And basically they were entrapped, I think, in many ways. And it's a real lesson about how international monitors have to be prepared. They have to ask tough questions. They can't be led around by information ministers or whatever. And so everything about Terezin is phony and horrible. And to see it now as kind of a quiet place just adds to the pathos of it.
You write at length in your book about the lead-up and the signing of the Munich Agreement, which has become one of the great historical tragedies. It's the word appeasement is always associated with it. Does your experience as a diplomat give you insight into how that whole thing transpired?
It does. You know, I think that as a somebody who is a decision maker, you try very hard to avoid war. I think because everybody knows the suffering of war. And one of the things I learned as I went back over the record is that both the British and French were deeply scarred by World War I. They had lost an awful lot of people. There was an attempt in the interwar period to avoid war. The League of Nations was created. There were a bunch of agreements signed, Kellogg-Briand, in order to avoid war. And I think that Neville Chamberlain, to the best gloss that I can put on it, wanted to avoid war. The terrible lesson out of it, though, is that these agreements, the Munich Agreement, was made over the head of the Czechoslovaks. They never were in the room. And decisions were made about them. And so I think the fact that major countries can make decisions about the fate of small countries is something that comes out of this. And Munich, as you say, I mean, the word appeasement is synonymous with it.
And no matter what Neville Chamberlain achieved otherwise, he'll always be associated with that terrible agreement.
Terrible, you know, the umbrella and peace in our time. And then saying something else, which is, why should we care about people in faraway places with unpronounceable names? And that was something that stuck in my mind when I was ambassador at the United Nations, which, by the way, was before I found out about my Jewish background, and I was dealing with Bosnia. And all of a sudden, I saw pictures of people being put into trains or buses and sent to some kind of labor camps. And all I could think of were people in a faraway place with unpronounceable names. And so the lessons of that are very much a part of what I'm writing about.
Madeleine Albright served, excuse me, as America's 64th Secretary of State from 1997 to 2001. Her distinguished career also includes positions on Capitol Hill, on the National Security Council, and as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. She has written 5 books. The most recent, is this your 6th or your 5th?
5th.
Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance and War, 1937-1948, published by Harper. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you so much. Thanks for a great interview, Leonard. Thank you.